Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this week's episode of It's Easy, Son, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. I trust that everyone had a great week, and after hearing the stories of Malcolm Graham and Beverly Tatum and others over the last several weeks, the calls and the feedback and the texts that I've received tells me that these stories and the podcast is indeed inspiring people to take, you know, deeper looks at their lives and just be inspired by the stories of those gone before them. Well, today I have a young man that's joining me. I do say young man. He's quite young, but he has had an interesting journey thus far, and he's joining us. I learned of him from a colleague who religiously listens to the podcast and shared with me his story. A young man that went to the same high school I went to in Jamaica, Kingston College, but has gone through a lot and has put his thoughts and his journey into a book. And I won't say too much about the book. I'll let it all come out by way of our talk, as I always do. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce to the podcast this week, Mr. Pete Kennedy. Mr. Pete Kennedy is a young man who has a story that we'll spend some time learning about him and his story and how he got to the point of writing this book. So hopefully this will be another one of those stories that we can all garner something from. Without any further ado, let's just jump right in. Mr. Kennedy, how are you, sir?
I'm doing awesome. Thank you very much, Gerald, for having me on your program, and you're doing an awesome work, and appreciate it. It's an honor, sir. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. I learned of you from a fellow Fortison, Perry Bloomfield, who is also the president of the Kingston College Old Boy Association. When he told me about your book and he sent me the cover and everything else, I said, I definitely want to speak with this young man. So today you have an opportunity to share a little bit about you and how you got here and your inspirational story. So let us jump right in. Who is Pete Kennedy? Yep. Tell us a little bit about Pete, your early years, and how did you come to, you know, get to this point of writing this book?
Well, it started right there in the island of Jamaica, born and raised in the city of Kingston. And my early years, Gerald, started right there at a street called Goodwin Park Road, directly in front of Alpha Boys Academy on South Camp Road. And from those early years, I was interested in the things that I saw that was happening around me. And very quickly, my parents, who were very hardworking individuals, were able to purchase a home in a neighboring community, which is called Almontown. And we moved and lived on Arnold Road, which was very much adjacent to Big T Bag Juice Factory. If you're in that facility, in that vicinity, Big T Bag Juice Factory, our apartment building was directly in front of it. And next to that was the Arnold Road Methodist Church that we became members of and joined at one point. And immediately, right there, as we moved into that specific location, about a year after, we actually got impacted by Hurricane Gilbert. Remember that popular song that came out about Wild Wild Gilbert? And it was something that I never forgot. I remember seeing roofs coming off of homes, and just something kind of wrecked the island at that time. And we survived and came through. And then I took the common entrance exam at that time, which I understand is the prep exam now, or formerly GSAT. And I was so excited that I was able to pass the common entrance and move on to high school. And now this is where it gets interesting. I had an older brother at home, and he was actually attending KC at the time. And for some reason, I just didn't want to be looked over or have a shadow of someone at me in high school. So, Gerald, I did a brave move, and I decided to actually go to Jamaica College, which is JC. And it's surprisingly, when everyone hears this story, this is going to be new for a lot of my friends, because where the way I talk about Kingston College and the impact KC had had on my life, the championship I've won there, It's a lot of people are going to be shocked to hear that my first year of high school was at Jamaica College. And it was a learning point. I represented Jamaica College in the Pepsi Schoolboy competition, wore the blue and white, and my mom decided, nah, this has to stop. Another stopping moment in my life. And Gerald, she said, you're no longer going to Hope Road. I'm sending you to KC. And my second year of high school, all the way till the time I left high school, was spent at the Fortis location there at Melbourne and North Street.
So, wow, mom had that much power. So you talk about your mom and she having you move from one institution to another. Talk a little bit about your mom, your home life, and what grounded you during those early years.
I'm glad you mentioned her, because she's really, I would say, someone who had really, when we talk about tough love, Gerald, my mom showed me some very tough love. And what happened is that when I attended JC, I spent a lot of time at Hope Gardens. I know you pretty much are familiar with Hope Gardens, was right there, and we would jump the wall and we would spend a lot of time at Hope Gardens, and that was pretty much what was on my report. And she said, I need you to go to a school where your brother was doing well. My brother played cricket, Sunline Cup, Marlon Kennedy played Sunline Cup for KC and was moving on, excelling. And she says, no, let me get you somewhere where people already know of the Kennedys. So that way, if anything happens, someone would look out for you. And she just knew that there was something that I had that from I was a little boy, she called me Stumpy because I was very short growing up in high school. And I only started to grow when I actually got to the state. I think it was something with the food. That's what everybody says. But I was very short. And she called me Stumpy, and my friends at that time called me Daddy. And I remember her saying to me, she's saying, if everybody looks up to you and this thing with this big mouth, I'm always the loudest one wherever I am. I'm always the center of the crowd. People would probably call it you're self-centered, or you feel like you're the life of the party somewhat. But that was me, Gerald, from a little boy. But what I discovered as I continued to grow is mom didn't have the tools to actually take my talent to that next level. Mm-hmm. And I must say, she stuck with it. She knew there was something in me, and she just kept pushing me to actually search and find more, because she could only do so much. And when it got to a point when she saw that, hey, my son needs a little bit more. I was trying to get a scholarship out of Kingston College to go to the States to play soccer. That didn't happen. But what happened very, very, very uniquely there, Gerald, is my family members, a few years prior to that, had all migrated to Chicago, Illinois, where my grandma was filing for all of us. Mm. But my mom and my dad were the only siblings that was married. So if you understand the filing process a little bit, if there's any sibling that's married, their process is handled a little bit differently, because now you have spouses and kids mm-hmm. involved. So we were left behind. And it so happens, as soon as I graduate high school, she decided, hey, you know what? I need to take him out, get him into some environment where this excitement and this dude that just wants to learn and get into everyone's face, I need him to get some exposure. And she realized that what I had at that time, Almondtown, and I'm not going to say the little Jamaica, but just my surrounding, couldn't offer me the things that she felt I need to excel. So when she saw that at Kingston College, we won the 1994 Coles Championship, she said, hey, let's do this, because I was the vice captain of that team, and I was just looking for something more that she couldn't offer, and knew that there was just something that I could actually achieve by getting some exposure in the different areas.
Now, one of the things, you know, I'm a Fortison myself, and Kingston College molded me and shaped me in many ways mm-hmm. and launched me into my time in college and onward. Well, what was Kingston College like for you?
Kingston College, I would say, was my glory days. I enjoyed it. I loved it. And I remember when I first went to KC, everyone was like, oh, you're going to play cricket. You're going to play cricket, because that's what my brother did. And, you know, first year starting out my Pepsi, it wasn't the greatest. You know, you learn the sport a little bit. And I had a friend by the name of Kizran Levy, who's my best friend today. And he said to me, hey, let's go play some soccer. And Almonton was right next to the National Heroes Park. So we went to Hero Circle almost every day after school, playing, practicing. And I went out for the Colts team and got selected for the team. So did he. And we won almost every game that year leading up to the championship. That kind of took me to a level of, wow, this is what teamwork is about. This is how we can get things accomplished. But we lost that championship, Gerald. We lost to Norman Manley 4-0 in the National Stadium. And I've never seen young men cry like that before. These guys bawled. I mean, it shocked me so much. I stood up looking at them. It wasn't even the fact of how we lost. I was like, wow, because it meant so much to them. But as a kid, I didn't really kind of understand it at that moment when we talk about the love and the chemistry we had. But when we went to the next year in 1994, and we were under the leadership of Coach Stratton Palmer at the time, and he saw what we had that year, we took it up a notch with just minor adjustments to the team. And with myself and I would say Fabian Clark, who was the captain at that time, we led that team to a championship in the National Stadium. We played Norman Manley again, and this time we ended up beating them 3-0. But there were some individuals at Kingston College that really looked out for me. I would say that Mr. Johnson, Jono, who we all are familiar with, there were times I remember I would get in a little trouble at school and he would say, Pete, come on, you can do way better than this. But, you know, when you're influenced by other things outside of the home, which is your community, the men that you see do things in the society, even my dad as a role model itself, it can have an impact if you're not having that support within the home. So Casey did a lot for me, and Casey is one of the reasons why actually I wrote this book, where seeing that leadership, where I was able to get that exposure playing 93-94 Colts, when I went to the 1995 Manning Cup team under the leadership of Vernon Bell, there was difference. And I was like, why? The results were different. And Gerald, if you kind of follow how the schoolboy soccer thing, you know, works, is when you go from one year to the other, it's normally the same set of guys. Right. I was like, how is it we won in 94? We have almost the same set of guys and some way better guys, and we can't win a game?
Wow.
That was something. That was something. But my highlight moment came again at KC when we were playing against Wilmers High School. I can't forget this game, Gerald. And I remember one of the famous footballers from the island, Bibi Gardner, was playing for Wilmers at the time, who represented us in the World Cup. And there was a famous goalkeeper by the name of Pendergrass, and Coach Bell put me on, Gerald, and I'm telling you, I'm nervous. You know, North Street, look, it's crowded on all four sides of the field, and this was a game where everybody needed to see. And when he put me on, he said, go and play midfield. And then he said, play left mid. Now, Gerald, Coach was doing something that wasn't the norm. One, he normally doesn't have me practice playing midfield because I was a defender. And number two, my strong foot, Gerald, is the right foot. So why would you put me in I wouldn't say uncomfortable because I've played midfield before, but, you know, not something of the norm. And then also on the weak leg. But Gerald, something tremendously happened. So a teammate of mine, Dwight Gordon, kicked the ball over. It was Andrew Henry. Swung a nice ball over, and I could run. So I took off. Boom. And Gerald, I'm heading down the field, and I picked it up. And when I realized, Gerald, I was in front of the goal, and it was just me and the goalkeeper. And Gerald, I lined it up. And when I went, bam, and I hit that ball off the weaker foot, Gerald, rather than going to the goal, it went across the field to the opposite side of the field. But here's the funny part about it. My teammate was running on Dwight Gordon, scratchy, and he tapped it in, and we went up 1-0, and I never felt so joyous in my life, and everybody ran on the field, and they lift us up, and I was like, oh, I got an assist, but it was really not. It was off a weaker foot trying to shot that goal. But when we came out of that game, and seeing the love and everything that we had was something that was just amazing. And it really kind of exposed me to some things that really later on in life I wanted to do and wanted to take part of. But one of the things I also mentioned in the book, which we're going to get to a little bit later, is talking about having that guidance once the actual skill or the talent is identified. So Casey really, really put me into an opportunity where I was able to see leadership, work with leadership, get to be led under some great leaders, as well as the opportunity to see the success through it. So
that is true. That is truly awesome. So you finish up Kingston College. Your time is moving. You're a student athlete. What happened after Kingston College? What was next for Pete Kennedy after Kingston College?
Here comes Chicago. So my mom now says, all right, it's time to go. And we left for Chicago. My dad and my mom and myself left. Marlon, my brother, was not able to come because now he was over 21. So now he's in a situation where now my mom had to come to the States and do something totally different for him. So when we got to the States, immediately my mom signed me up for college. And Gerald, when we're driving into the college to go to the admissions office to start the process, I'm looking all over and I'm like, I didn't see a basketball court. There's no soccer field, not even a tennis court, Gerald. So the entire interview, I am distracted. And the gentleman then looks over to me and says, young man, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, I'm okay, but I'm concerned. And he's like, what? I said to him, I didn't see any type of field or a court coming into this school. What's going on? And then my mom turns to me and she says, no, you're going to come to this school. It's the 21st century and we're going into computers and you're going to study computers. And you know, the Caribbean parent mentality is what I say you're going to do is what you're going to do, which is also something I speak against in my book, is once we spend some time around our kids and identify those skills, let's get them into things that they love. But she signed me up at DeVry Institution of Technology, at the time was the name. By the time I graduated, it was DeVry University. But when I started college, there was no soccer to play. So what I ended up having to do is actually play soccer at the club level, which I did end up winning two championships there. Well, you know what was funny about all of that, Gerald, mm-hmm. is in the midst of actually going to school, in the midst of playing soccer, my personal life turned for the worse.
Mm.
I got affiliated with drugs. I got affiliated with a gang. And by the time you... Quint is what we would say back home. I was living a lifestyle that my mom was not happy with. Had to leave the house, be on my own, and then this is where now it's really get to the nitty gritty. And I ended up getting in trouble, almost lost my life. And I remember once being on the street corners of Chicago. I got a phone call from my brother Marlon, who, you know, we left in the island, who had joined the military at that time. And it was regular for us to speak on the phone. We had grown to a relationship where we understood we needed each other. And because of my lifestyle, he was just looking out for me, saying, hey, I want to make sure I'm staying in contact with you to make sure you're okay. And it's so funny that Marlon was leading and loving since I was a little boy, but he also didn't have that guidance to tap into it, to give me that special support. But mm-hmm. he was doing this all this time. And the phone call I received that night, Gerald, was to say to me that my dad had passed away. And, I remember sitting on the street corner and I just couldn't believe my dad had passed away, because we had just started our relationship in regards to getting to kind of speak as men, which we didn't have when I was growing as a child. And I looked at myself on that street corner, Gerald, and I saw myself as the walking dead.
Wow.
Here I am. I'm looking out for either rival gang, the cops, or just not wanting to go to jail And if my dad wasn't living this lifestyle and died, look at me. And I said to myself, Pete, you need a change. But again, with no guidance, no leadership, how do you make that change? So Chicago was a really, really, I would say, bittersweet moment for me for the times that was there. But it has also helped to lead me to where we are today.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So if you hadn't gotten that call from your brother, if you reflect back on that time, because this, you know, you talk about it in your book, but what would have been the outcome if you didn't have that, I guess you can call it flashpoint, of just sitting on that corner that night?
Well, Gerald, it probably would have been the same, because Gerald, the person that I am now, with enhanced relationship and understand how to, handle myself in certain positions, it's the very same Pete back then, but I just didn't have the controls of things. So when we talk about having individuals wanting to just talk to me just for any reasons and these things, the attraction that came with it, the money that came with it, I wish I knew, Gerald, because I would have paid off my school fees. If somebody had, guided me to say, hey, Pete, if you have $75,000 right now, go pay your school fee. I didn't know what to do with $75,000 at 21 years old. I think it would have gone for the worst. The reason being is my dad wanted to build a relationship with me at that time that he accepted my lifestyle, but my mother didn't. So The things that I would do and wanted to share, he would listen, and my mom wouldn't.
Wow.
And here's the difference. I remember once going to my mom's house, Gerald, and leaving a certain amount of cash. I was going to say a little bit over about $3,000. And my mom took her crochet. You remember crochet with that, Caribbean appearance? She took her crochet. I don't know where she finds figurine in Chicago, but she had her figurine and crochet, Gerald. And she took the crochet and she covered up that money. She didn't even touch it with her hands, Gerald.
Mm.
And she called me for 3 weeks to come get the money. And she was working 2 jobs in the cold. She worked at Home Depot, and she worked at a nursing home called the Mather, which was, I would say, downtown Evanston at the time. And she was working 2 jobs. You know what that money could have done for her?
Mm-hmm.
But when a parent believes and has faith that, hey, I want my son to change, she's not going to be a part of it. The reason I went and got the money, she said, if I don't come get it, she's going to give it to her friend. And at that time, I'm like, $3,000 could do me well on the street right now. I could go get me some J's. I could go, probably right. Go out with a girl. So I went and picked up the money. That's the only reason I did, because she said if I didn't come get it, she was going to give it away. And that's the type of parent I had, but still lack the essentials to take me to that next level.
Mm.
So I felt if I didn't get that call, it may have gone for the worse.
So let's pivot a little bit now, because this book that you've written, I've read just the flap that was sent to me.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. And I was talking with just exchanging messages with Mr. Bloomfield, and he is saying this young man's story is incredible. You're now 41, I think, right?
That's correct. You're 41.
Yeah, you're a young 41. So let's talk now about the pivot from the story you just described. What happened and what turned you to where you are now, such that you have written a book and you're actually trying to inspire other young people by way of this book? What happened? Walk us through that.
What I realized, Gerald, is this. Jamaican music, Jamaican society, Jamaican culture, and I'll go as far as say as Jamaican men do not set up a youth for success if there isn't strong support and leadership within their life. And I would say that because there was a song that was written by one of our popular dancehall artists. He was also a Grammy Award winner. And that song took my life for a part of the worst, which is also leading to where we are today. Now, I'm not an artist. I love to sing, but I don't want to be judged by my singing style at this moment. But I'm just going to give just a little small snippet of the song so you understand where I'm coming from.
Okay, okay.
And this is our famous, we call him Dr. Beanie Man. And Dr. Beanie Man sing a song when I was growing up in Almondtown like this. It says, "Man fee have enough gyal and gyal in a bungle. Gyal from Rima, gyal from jungle. Enough gyal and none of them nuffy grumble." And I'll stop right there.
Okay, that's pretty good.
Thank you. But that song became my lifestyle. Born and raised in Almondtown right there. Rima was just a stone throw away. Jungle was just a stone throw away. So, Gerald, I could relate. I could understand. And then when on the street corners, I hear the very same thing within the men that I actually look up to or will call somebody I would like to follow. They're doing the same thing. They're having many women. They're having all these baby mamas. And this was the lifestyle. So as a young man growing up in Jamaica, that is what was taught to be. Now, I'm going to fast forward just a little bit and say what happened after I decided to change my life in Chicago is I heard some stories of Florida that were through the goggles of the eyes of individuals who were drug dealers and gangbangers, and I never wanted to move to Florida. And my apartment burnt down, Gerald. Don't know how. And I had to move. There was nowhere else I could go. My girlfriend at the time told me I couldn't stay there, even though I was paying for her rent and all of these things. That's another one to catch in the book. But I had to move to Florida. And when I moved to Florida and changed the whole dynamic of my approach and things, I realized that Florida would work for me because I was now looking through the goggles of totally different eyes. I wasn't looking through the goggles of a drug dealer or a gangbanger anymore. And I saw things differently. Then I started to step into the aspects of what is it that TEED is all about and how can I improve? So I started to focus on the change. Met a wonderful young lady, got married. Focused on the change. I later realized one day, Gerald, as I was actually going home for lunch, I was managing one of the largest U.S. banks in the States, and I had a specific branch that was assigned to me, and I lived about 7 minutes away from home. I was going home for lunch, and when I got there, there was a U-Haul truck in my driveway. So, Gerald, I'm like, okay, this may be my neighbor, because we were pretty, very good friends with the neighbors. The community was very quiet. But, Gerald, as I walked to my door, I realized that my door was propped open. So, Gerald, the Jamaican, kicked into me, "Yo, wagwan." So I turned and went to the back of the house and looked through the sliding door, which was transparent to see, and I saw that there were some men moving my bedroom set, but they didn't look like thieves, you know, because they were casually, you know, moving the stuff and laughing. You know, no thieves move like that. So I go around the front, and Gerald, when I walk into the house, to my surprise and shock, there was my aha moment, is my ex-wife is moving out of the house without me knowing.
Wow.
If I hadn't gone home on lunch, I would have gone home to a half empty house. And Gerald, I stopped immediately there, and I looked again at myself, observing, which is one that I strongly recommend individuals to do, and I said, "Pete, you need to change. This has to stop. God did not create us to walk in balance." Now, I'm not saying that your life needs to be balanced, but God didn't create us to walk in balance. And what I mean by that is, my professional life cannot be going in one direction, which is excelling and doing all of these things for these corporations and learning and growing and getting promoted, when personally it's failing. And that is why in my book I have my two hands out, because when a man loves, everything is embodied in that. So when we talk about being balanced in life as a walk, God didn't create us to do that. And I stopped in that moment, Gerald, and said, I need to change. There's no way I can be successful at this. There's no way I can be doing these things and want the dreams and aspirations in life. And that was because I took on the lifestyle of that song of being a man as a youth growing up to that point. I had many women in my life. And because of what I did as a speaker, trainer, and coach, as I grew through the secular jobs and promotions, it was easy because people saw me as a leader. And because of my charisma as well, I easily attracted people. And at that moment, I said to myself, I needed therapy. I needed therapy. And it was then I discovered the true Pete Kennedy.
So, Pete, I'm listening to you speak and your story, and it sounds to me that even at 41 years old, you've had some experiences, and each experience was a lesson learned. So yeah. Now that you are beyond that and you've learned some of these lessons, it makes sense, the book that you have written. But walk me through how the lessons now turn into you giving back, or how has that changed you in today's current dispensation in your time and in your efforts?
One is going back to my statement earlier, I realized that there's not enough of us speaking and teaching, especially our youth. And in the book, the title says, When a Man Loves. And it's not directly speaking to the male sex itself. The Bible says, I call ye men unto me. And at that moment, we were talking about both men and women. So the title was given to me specifically in my vision as we're speaking about both men and women. But because these are my life experiences, because these are my studies, my research, my observation, it's being told and written from a male's perspective. But to further answer your question, so to speak, in realizing that these things were not given to me as an early age, I said to myself, I need to start researching and getting things together to offer this to other individuals. So I started writing my circle. I started with my best friend, Kizran Levy. The first time I told him I love him, I never heard him curse so much in my life. And we've done some things. I was like, dude, he's like, he just kept on. And I was like, he's like, yo, what do you mean? And you know, the whole Jamaican mentality. Mm-hmm. Like, yep. I can't tell you I love you. And we slept on the same bed. We've hidden the same cars. And the list goes on when we talk about two young men from the age of 13 to this day. And he had to get used to it. And I start realizing that when it comes to love, when I observe the Bible and read and look at things and everything and look at other cultures, I have friends from all different cultures in the world. I can't think of one culture I don't have a friend in. And when I look in those specific cultures and I look at their lifestyle, it is taught. And what I realize in my culture is that we are not teaching our youth how to love and how to lead. But we teach them how to build a house. We teach them how to build cars. We teach them how to build roads. Now, I'm not saying those things are not important, but who you spend the rest of your life with is also important. And I think even more important, because when you leave that work and you go home, who are you going home to? That individual. These things are not taught to us. So I have taken on the baton, not even the baton, I've taken up this torch. And I know it's not an easy one. I know it's not one that may be accepted by all. But so far, everyone that I've spoken to and shared my story has seen the importance of how we need to start investing in the youth in our actual communities and in our homes. So this is the step to start making that mental change in Jamaica, within the world, within the states, and my group and organization that I work with say we're taking the approach one household at a time. So we just want to change the mindset in regards to how we think and how we look at love and how we lead. And if you don't mind, I want to share this story with, which I briefly shared with you when we talked a little bit. While I worked for a large mobile company, they sent me to the Philippines to actually do some training. And at this moment, I was a trainer traveling and doing some things. And they took me to the Philippines. I said, ooh, I want to go. I'd love this exposure. And this was another aha moment where I started the research. And even when I discovered this, it came back further, Gerald. The behavior didn't change because sometimes we need that aha thing to happen. So I was in the Philippines. I was in Manila, Iloilo, and Pampanga. I spent pretty much about 3 to 4 months there. And while I was in Iloilo, I saw some things that it was jaw-dropping. I thought I was in Jamaica. They cook chicken adobo, which is brown stew chicken in Jamaica. They cooked a similar curry chicken to us. The only thing that they didn't have, which was authentic to us, was a jerk chicken. They had oxtail. And at that moment, I'm like, I thought Jamaica was the best thing ever. But these guys were doing the similar thing as us in Jamaica, and I loved it. But as I was teaching in the classroom, Gerald, there was a young man that I realized that as I got close to him, he was getting a shell. And they took us to out a hut to eat one day. And when we actually started to serve the food, and while you're in the Philippines, if you're not in a restaurant, you eat with your hands. And this guy was sitting down, and the only seat available was beside him. When I went to sit beside him, Gerald, he started to shake. Now, this was all the leader in me and all the love in me. I wanted to find out what was happening. And this is why I know this specific move that I'm on, all these experiences that I've gone through, like you said, young 41, is because this story has to be told and for this specific reason. He looked at me, Gerald. I was in my late 20s at that time, and he was in his late 30s. So the guy is 10 years older than me. And he looks at me, Gerald, and he says, Pete, never in my life I thought I would meet a black man. Gerald, this is 2008.
Wow.
I almost fell off the little stump I'm sitting on. I said, what do you mean? He says, we're so poor. I don't go to the mall. I don't come out the house. And when I come to work, I don't leave until Friday. There's nothing, nowhere for me to go. I just stay home. So when I see a black person is on the TV, I was like, nah, you tripping. Gerald, when the guy starts to pinch my skin, as if he wants to make sure I was really black, Gerald, that's when I started to tear up. I was like, God, what are you, I can't believe this in 21st century. I didn't believe him. He said to me, Pete, go to the mall. And my company had told me, don't go to the mall, don't go anywhere. They provided everything for us, Gerald. I didn't have to lift a straw when I was in the Philippines. But you know me, the Jamaican in me, and you know, born and raised in Almanton, I'm like, yo, Not up to me, I'm a good man. So I took it and went to the mall. And Gerald, I couldn't spend 3 minutes in the mall. I'm not even going to go to 5, 3 minutes. Because you know kids, when kids see things, kids are definitely sincere, genuine, and truthful. And when I see kids walking up saying to me, Mom, Mom, he's black. Gerald, I couldn't stay in the mall. Kids are pulling on my pants. They're calling me Dwayne Wade. At that time, Dwayne Wade was the big player for the Miami Heat. And I guess they watched a lot of Miami Heat and basketball. So I guess the only black man some of them have ever seen. And everybody likes Dwayne Wade. They're just linking me to him. And I mean, I'll take the credit off a handsome Dwayne Wade and his money. But nowhere looked like Dwayne Wade at all. But it's the only thing they could relate to. And Gerald, when I left, I said, wow, this is different. But here's the breaking point, and then we're going to move on a little bit, is they invited me to a club. And when I went to the club, we started drinking and having some fun. And then a guy started to dance with me, Gerald. Could you believe that? A guy started to dance with me. Now, born and raised in Jamaica, what do you think I'm going to do with Gerald if a guy starts to dance with you? If me go to Jamaica right now, I start there, I'm me going to walk and dance with a guy, I'll probably get shot, right?
Right.
So my immediate reaction is, I pushed him. I'm like, yo, where I'm from? And Gerald, it almost turned into a fight. Someone had to step in and say, no, Pete is not from here. This is a culture shock for Pete. And Gerald, I stood back the whole night. I started to observe these people. And these men were dancing. When I said dancing, Gerald, you see like how we dance in Jamaica and we do a little, you know, they were dancing to that like us as men. And when the party was done, and when we left that club, they were holding hands, keeping each other safe, and not to fall on the floor, I guess, walk into the car. They hugged each other, and Gerald, I observed this afterwards, and I started to ask, what's going on? Why is it these guys can live like this, but I can't tell my best friend that I've been with for most of my life that I love him? So I started to do some research, and I found out during slavery days in Jamaica, there was a thing called buck breaking or bucking, where the slave masters would take the males that were strong or anyone they saw as a leader, and they would rape them in front of the plantation. This has been brought down within the male generation within Jamaica for years. Awareness is knowledge, Gerald. Knowledge is power. I don't think a lot of us in Jamaica know this. And this is why we hold on to these homophobic things and don't want to tell your sons you love them. You don't want to tell your brother you love him. I can't look at my best friend that I've known for over 20 odd years and tell him I love him. All because of something that happened to us during slavery that has been taught and held on to and brought down from generation to generation to generation that also impacted me. And all I'm here to say is in my book, Jerry, is when a man loves, he protects, he communicates, he's transparent in his communication, he is honest, he is trustworthy, and he influences those that he leads. And we can only do that when we truly open up our arms and love. And this is where we've led to today, where having that experience in the Philippines, doing some further research in Jamaica, also outside of Jamaica, I've realized that outside of the teaching that we didn't get, that there is something that happened to us way back in history that has been taught within the culture of our island that is impacting us. And I believe if we can change that, the violence alone in Jamaica will decrease. If we can change, because I don't understand how you can ride up on a street corner and just blow some for no reason. And some of that is because the men in Jamaica have no emotions. They have no emotions. And some of them are the biggest babies. It's just that we were raised to be tough. We were raised to be strong. We were raised to not show any emotions. We were raised not even to say the word love. And I want to change that mindset one household at a time.
So Pete, let me ask you a question. That's a very interesting story. Cultural differences always get interpreted through a certain lens, but changing one household at a time. So I looked at your book, and on the back, I see you have two young people, and I'm assuming your wife is on the back with you.
Oh, yes.
So as I'm listening to you speak about the experiences and the message that you're trying to portray about love and leadership, the latter, leadership, is your book trying to get, because you said you didn't want to have it gender based in terms of, you know, although you say when a man loves it's the same for women, when a woman love, I guess, is the leadership component in terms of your home and the society in general, is that the broader context for the word love in as you are portraying it?
Yes and no. And the reason I say yes and no is this. The other thing that I also definitely talk about heavily in the book is leadership is love, love is leadership. My family on the back there, as you see, that young lady is my childhood girlfriend. She actually helped me with one of the observations that we dated when we were 13, 14.
Really?
We actually didn't break up. Yeah, we actually didn't break up. I just left the island and, you know, just separated. And then we all just, you know, picked up our lives from there and moved on. When I got divorced and I'm doing the research, I called her and I said, hey, I'm coming to Jamaica. And I'm doing this activity, but I want some help. Can you help me? I said, hey, I want to treat you how a man should treat a woman in public. I want to do all these things. I want to open the door. I want to hold your hand. I want to do all these things in public and see what the reaction is. And all the time through Jamaica and doing all of these things, Gerald, for the week I was there, I saw a lot of faces. I get a little, you know, the grunts and this, but no open verbiage. And I went to Manor Park to KFC that was my last night to buy some food to head back home. You know, we always bring that good KFC back home.
right.
And I took her out the car, the same thing. And this is why when we talk about process and system, you have to stick to it to the very end. This was the last night, Jerry. So I could have actually given up and say, hey, I'm not doing it anymore. I've been doing it for a week here. So last night, I'm dropping her off. I'm going to KFC. I could have ended and opened up the door for her, did all these things, let her in, put her in. We came out. I did the same thing, put her in the car. And when I put her in the car and I'm walking around, you know, in Jamaica, you know, business owners have security. This guy came out and he's like, yo. And I turned around and he's like, yeah, man, you. And I said, me? And him said, yeah. Him said, what happened, boss? I go and shove on that way, I treat her so. And I was like,
wow.
But I went in the car, Gerald, and I said, thank you, Jesus. And she was like, what happened? I said, I got the one verbiage that I needed. Because, Gerald, everybody was looking at me crazy at that time. Everybody, and I've gone to Jamaica since, and I've seen differences. So good job to the island, and I've seen some improvement there. So I don't want to knock it as if there hasn't been improvement. There is, but in the inner cities, we need more. So I said to her, the guy said to me that you had gold under you when I was treating you this. And you know, you and I understand the interpretation is that what he's saying is, why am I treating you with all this care, all this love, all this nurturing in public?
Wow.
When that's what we should do. So I took that, ran with it, started doing some more research, did some here within the local states as well. And what I've seen is that that specific same type of love is when you bring it in the workplace, Jerry, it works the same way. Because when we talk about leadership in the workplace, when we talk about risk, when we talk about trust, when we talk about integrity, when we talk about communication, at the high levels that I and the roles that I play in organizations, they are to the point, well looked at, and drawn out. But when we come home, we don't want to communicate. Think about it. When you go on the street corners of Jamaica, you can't shut them guys up. But when they're home, you can't get them to say anything. How? My passion is coming out.
That's okay.
But that's the thing. And I'm like, how is it that the place that you should be communicating is the place that you're not? I'm not saying not to talk on the streets, but we're quiet at home. And I've gone out with my dad. I shared this in the story. And when my dad was out is what you see me today, the talker, the this, the that. But when my dad was at home, sometimes I'd be like, is this the same dude? Because, Jerry, he's not doing anything but quiet or sleeping. Very little communication at home. And in my book, I talk about doing the balance. You can't be a different person at home and a different person at work. Now, I'm not going to say that depending on your job, you might have to be a little bit stern. For example, if you work at a prison and you're a warden, I don't expect you to come home and just command your family, go over there now, dude. No, I don't expect that. But you have to understand the family you have. You have to understand the things that you have. And this is why in the book I talk about the most should, could model that was taught to me by my brother that I've taken to the next level and mastered. And that is the standards in life that we have, that every organization have, every team have, every sports have. It's the very same way in our lives. We need to have these standards with our most shoulds and coulds. Now, when I'm actually speaking to my clients who I coach, and when I do seminars and workshops, and I ask these questions about personal life compared to professional, we got the whole professional worked out. But the personal, we don't spend any time on.
Interesting.
And that's what the book presents and offers, is that if we're going to spend a lot of time on these things professionally, let's do the same thing personally. And I guarantee you, Gerald, I guarantee you that from what I've seen with everybody that I've worked for, never failed.
Never failed. Now, never Pete, failed. We have approximately 10 minutes left. An hour has zoomed by, as is usually the case with the guests. But if you had three things that you would like to share about the book. Now, the topic that you're tackling and the fact that it's coming from our tiny home island of Jamaica, a lot of interest, but some might say, well, you know, that's just not us. You know, we don't do those types. We don't show love and things like that in that nature. If there were three things that you are trying to portray and convey to the audience, and, you know, this is going to be heard a number of places, what would those three things be?
The first thing that I would say is self-identification. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is Facet. That is the four behavior styles that exist. You can find them in many places. You can find it in the DISC. You can find it in Myron Bridge. And I break it down into layman's terms. So it's the feeler, controller, entertainer, and thinker. Facet. Once an individual understands who they are, there is highly guaranteed to improve their performance and also improve their relationships. Because when I discovered that I was a true entertainer, Gerald, I just knew that when I'm at work and I'm dealing with certain controllers, I'm not going with a joke. I'm not going to give you a joke. I'm going directly giving you what you need because I understand I need this relationship to work. But it was also funny that when I discovered these things, I made sure that the next person I was going to spend the rest of my life with was going to be a filler. And my wife is a filler. And the reason for that is, as an entertainer, I stroke her ego all day. I do these things for her, and she loves it because that's what fillers like. So when I come home and I could, you know, pinch her on her ears and she's like, oh, make it funny, she that works for her. If I did that to a controller when I walk through the door at the moment, I'd probably get the pan thrown at me or something like that. And these are the dynamics. When you understand these things, you'll enhance relationship. The second one that we teach immediately after that is really taking that specific self-identification to the level of passion. I truly believe once you find your passion turns into servitude, and servitude turns into wealth, and wealth turns into you living a fulfilled life. So we talk about really identifying your passion and what is it that you want to do rather than careers. So I have a degree in computer information system. What am I doing today? I'm a speaker. Yeah, if you ask me to do anything with a network or a system, I might call someone else. It was good education. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
So we kind of link those particular things together. And then the last but least is your must, should, could. And that's the methodology in regards to where I talk about breaking down your life into standards. I really believe in having strong mentorship or accountability partner. We need that, especially men, because we were created to speak and we were created to fellowship. So if a man doesn't have someone he can share with and talk to and get some of these things out, and this is why gangs are so powerful and street corners back home is so powerful, and this is all we do is talk, and we need that. So we talk about those models. I break them down into detail for you and help you to the next step that you can live that fulfilled life and enjoy your purpose.
Well said, sir. In the remaining time, what I'd like to do with all my guests is I just ask a fundamental question. What is next for Pete Kennedy?
Next is, I'm excited about the book launch that's coming. We're actually having the hard launch on December the 5th. Yourself and individuals have been helping me with promoting the book at this very moment. The next thing for Pete Kennedy is the Pete Kennedy Show. So similar to what you're doing here, I have actually been approached to actually do a similar show just like what you're doing. And it's actually all about ordinary people like me sharing a unique story. And we're starting right there at Kingston College with a 93-94 Colts team. I've got those guys together. Our coach Stratton Palmer is going to join us. And we're kicking off the Pete Kennedy Show with that, just taking ordinary people to share those unique stories like yourself.
Well, Mr. Kennedy, I'm going to say Mr. Kennedy now because you're a published author. I want to say to you, keep on keeping on. Our young people are our future. There are so many young people. I work in the business of raising up young leaders and social entrepreneurs. And it's voices like yours that has the courage to tackle things that most folks don't want to deal with, and in a cultural norm, that's going to be tough. I have an expression I use all the time: we can't fix what we won't face. And sir, you're tackling a topic here that will either resonate or it will cause you more grief. But the courage alone is what's going to carry you, ladies and gentlemen. We've just spent an hour with Mr. Pete Kennedy. His book is entitled When a Man Loves, and the byline is A Lifestyle and Leadership Most Men Will Never Experience. I am going to definitely get this book and read it, because not only because he's a Kingston College Fortison, but at the end of the day, if we take a look at our world and we see what is happening, we are a divided nation, we are a divided world, and at the end of the day, love is what really counts. So, Mr. Kennedy, thank you so much for gracing us with your presence, sir.
Thank you as well.
And good luck with the book. And if there's anything else that I can do to help you with it, I'll be more than happy to try to help, okay? Ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, have a great week, and we'll see you next week on It's Easy, Son. Life lessons on your journey to your purpose.